Obviously, Mr. Baines would be satisfied by whatever gift the ranking trade mission grafted to him through the good offices of Mr. Tagomi. But Mr. Tagomi, in asking the question, had had a deeper query in the back of his mind, one of which he was barely conscious. As so often, the oracle had perceived that more fundamental query, and, while answering the other, had taken it upon itself to answer the subliminal one, too. "As we know," Mr. Tagomi said, "Mr. Baines is bringing us detailed account of new injection molds developed in Sweden. Were we successfully to sign agreement with his firm, we could no doubt replace many present metals, quite scarce, with plastics." For years, the Pacific had been trying to get basic assistance in the synthetics field from the Reich. However, the big German chemical cartels, IG Farben in particular, had harbored their patents, had in fact created a world monopoly in plastics, especially in the development of the polyesters. By this means, Reich trade had kept an edge over Pacific trade, and in technology the Reich was at least 10 years ahead. The interplanetary rockets leaving Festung Europa consisted mainly of heat-resistant plastics, very light in weight, so hard that they survived even major meteor impact. The Pacific had nothing of this sort. Natural fibers such as wood were still used, and of course the ubiquitous pot metals. Mr. Tagomi cringed as he thought about it. He had seen at trade fairs some of the advanced German work, including an all-synthetic automobile, the DSS, Der Schnelle Spuk, which sold in PSA currency for about $600. But his underlying question, one which he could never reveal to the Pinocs flitting about trade mission offices, had to do with an aspect of Mr. Baines suggested by the original coded cable from Tokyo. First of all, coded material was infrequent and dealt usually with matters of security, not with trade deals. And the cipher was the metaphor type, utilizing poetic allusion, which had been adopted to baffle the Reich monitors, who could crack any literal code, no matter how elaborate. So clearly, it was the Reich whom the Tokyo authorities had in mind, not quasi-disloyal cliques in the home islands. The key phrase, "skim milk in his diet," referred to Pinafore, to the eerie song that expounded the doctrine, "Things are seldom what they seem. Skim milk masquerades as cream." And the I Ching, when Mr. Tagomi had consulted it, had fortified his insight. Its commentary? "Here a strong man is presupposed. It is true he does not fit in with his environment, inasmuch as he is too brusque and pays too little attention to form. But as he is upright in character, he meets with response." The insight was simply that Mr. Baines was not what he seemed, that his actual purpose in coming to San Francisco was not to sign a deal for injection molds, that, in fact, Mr. Baines was a spy. But for the life of him, Mr. Tagomi could not figure out what sort of spy, for whom, or for what. At 1:40 that afternoon, Robert Childan, with enormous reluctance, locked the front door of American Artistic Handcrafts, Incorporated. He lugged his heavy cases to the curb, hailed a pedicab, and told the Chink to take him to the Nippon Times building. The Chink, gaunt-faced, hunched over and perspiring, gasped a place-conscious acknowledgement and began loading Mr. Childan's bags aboard. Then, having assisted Mr. Childan himself into the carpet-lined seat, the Chink clicked on the meter, mounted his own seat, and pedaled off along Montgomery Street among the cars and buses. The entire day had been spent finding the item for Mr. Tagomi, and Childan's bitterness and anxiety almost overwhelmed him as he watched the buildings pass. And yet, triumph. The separate skill apart from the rest of him. He had found the right thing. And Mr. Tagomi would be mollified, and his client, whoever he was, would be overjoyed. I always give satisfaction, Childan thought, to my customers. He had been able to procure, miraculously, an almost mint copy of Volume 1, Number 1, of Tip Top Comics, dating from the 30s. It was a choice piece of Americana. One of the first funny books a prize collector's searched for constantly. Of course, he had other items with him to show first. He would lead up gradually to the funny book, which lay well protected in a leather case packed in tissue paper at the center of the largest bag. The radio of the pedicab blared out popular tunes, competing with the radios of other cabs, cars, and buses. Childan did not hear. He was used to it. Nor did he take notice of the enormous neon signs with their permanent ads obliterating the front of virtually every large building. After all, he had his own sign. At night it blazed on and off in company with all the others of the city. What other way did one advertise? One had to be realistic. In fact, the uproar of radios, traffic noises, the signs, and people lulled him. They blotted out his inner worries. And it was pleasurable to be pedaled along by another human being, to feel the straining muscles of the chink transmitted in the form of regular vibrations, a sort of relaxing machine, Childan reflected. To be pulled instead of having to pull. And to have, if even for a moment, higher place. Guiltily he woke himself. Too much to plan. No time for a midday doze. Was he absolutely properly dressed to enter the Nippon Times building? Possibly he would faint in the high-speed elevator, but he had motion illness tablets with him, a German compound. The various modes of address, he knew them, whom to treat politely, whom rudely. Be brusque with the doorman, elevator operator, receptionist, guide, any janitorial person. Bow to any Japanese, of course, even if it obliged him to bow hundreds of times. But the Pinox, nebulous area. Bow, but look straight through them as if they did not exist. Did that cover every situation, then? What about a visiting foreigner? Germans often could be seen at the trade missions, as well as neutrals. And then, too, he might see a slave. German or South ships docked at the port of San Francisco all the time, and blacks occasionally were allowed off for short intervals, always in groups of fewer than three. And they could not be out after nightfall. Even under Pacific law, they had to obey the curfew. But also slaves unloaded at the docks, and these lived perpetually ashore in shacks under the wharves above the waterline. None would be in the trade mission offices, but if any unloading were taking place, for instance, should he carry his own bags to Mr. Tagomi's office? Surely not. A slave would have to be found, even if he had to stand waiting an hour, even if he missed his appointment. It was out of the question to let a slave see him carrying something. He had to be quite careful of that. A mistake of that kind would cost him dearly. He would never have place of any sort again among those who saw. In a way, Childan thought, I would almost enjoy carrying my own bags into the Nippon Times building in broad daylight. What a grand gesture! It is not actually illegal. I would not go to jail, and I would show my real feelings, the side of a man which never comes out in public life. But I could do it, he thought, if there weren't those damn black slaves lurking around. I could endure those above me seeing it, their scorn. After all, they scorn me and humiliate me every day. But to have those beneath see me, to feel their contempt, like this chink peddling away ahead of me. if I hadn't taken a pedicab, if he had seen me trying to walk to a business appointment. One had to blame the Germans for the situation. Tendency to bite off more than they could chew. After all, they had barely managed to win the war, and at once they had gone off to conquer the solar system, while at home they had passed edicts which, well, at least the idea was good. And after all, they had been successful with the Jews and gypsies and Bible students. And the Slavs had been rolled back 2,000 years' worth to their heartland in Asia. Out of Europe entirely, to everyone's relief. Back to riding yaks and hunting with bow and arrow. And those great glossy magazines printed in Munich and circulated around to all the libraries and newsstands, one could see the full-page color pictures for oneself. The blue-eyed, blond-haired Aryan settlers who now industriously tilled, culled, plowed, and so forth in the vast grain bowl of the world, the Ukraine. Those fellows certainly looked happy, and their farms and cottages were clean. You didn't see pictures of drunken, dull-witted Poles anymore, slouched on sagging porches or hawking a few sickly turnips at the village market. All a thing of the past, like rutted dirt roads that once turned to slop in the rainy season, bogging down the carts. But Africa. They had simply let their enthusiasm get the better of them there. And you had to admire that, although more thoughtful advice would have cautioned them to perhaps let it wait a bit until, for instance, Project Farmland had been completed. Now there the Nazis had shown genius. The artist in them had truly emerged. The Mediterranean Sea bottled up, drained, made into tillable farmland through the use of atomic power. What daring! How the sniggerers had been set back on their heels, for instance, certain scoffing merchants along Montgomery Street. And as a matter of fact, Africa had almost been successful. But in a project of that sort, almost was an ominous word to begin to hear. Rosenberg's well-known powerful pamphlet issued in 1958. The word had first shown up then. As to the final solution of the African problem, we have almost achieved our objectives. Unfortunately, however... Still, it had taken 200 years to dispose of the American Aborigines. And Germany had almost done it in Africa in 15 years. So no criticism was legitimately in order. Childen had, in fact, argued it out recently while having lunch with certain of those other merchants. They expected miracles, evidently, as if the Nazis could remold the world by magic. No, it was science and technology and that fabulous talent for hard work. The Germans never stopped applying themselves. And when they did a task, they did it right. And anyhow, the flights to Mars had distracted world attention from the difficulty in Africa. So it all came back to what he had told his fellow store owners. What the Nazis have, which we lack, is nobility. Admire them for their love of work or their efficiency, but it's the dream that stirs one. Space flights first to the moon, then to Mars. If that isn't the oldest yearning of mankind, our finest hope for glory. Now, the Japanese, on the other hand, I know them pretty well. I do business with them, after all, day in and day out. They are, let's face it, Orientals. Yellow people. We whites have to bow to them because they hold the power, but we watch Germany. We see what can be done where whites have conquered, and it's quite different.
We approach the Nippon Times building, sir, the Chink said, his chest heaving from the exertion of the hill climbing. He slowed now.
To himself, Childen tried to picture Mr. Tagomi's client. Clearly, the man was unusually important. Mr. Tagomi's tone on the telephone,
his immense agitation had communicated the fact. Image of one of Childan's own very important clients, or rather, customers, swam up into his mind, a man who had done a good deal to create for Childan a reputation among the high-placed personages residing in the Bay Area. 4 years ago, Childan had not been the dealer in the rare and desirable which he was now. He had operated a small, rather dimly lighted, second-hand bookshop on Geary. His neighboring stores sold used furniture, or hardware, or did laundry. It was not a nice neighborhood. At night, strong-arm robberies and sometimes rape took place on the sidewalk, despite the efforts of the San Francisco Police Department and even the Kempei Tai, the Japanese higher-ups. All store windows had iron gratings fitted over them once the business day had ended, this to prevent forcible entry. Yet into this district of the city had come an elderly Japanese ex-army man, a Major Itohumo. Tall, slender, white-haired, walking and standing stiffly, Major Humo had given Childan his first inkling of what might be done with his line of merchandise. "I am a collector," Major Humo had explained. He had spent an entire afternoon searching among the heaps of old magazines in the store. In his mild voice, he had explained something which Childan could not quite grasp at the time. To many wealthy, cultured Japanese, the historic objects of American popular civilization were of equal interest alongside the more formal antiques. Why this was so, the Major himself did not know. He was particularly addicted to the collecting of old magazines dealing with U.S. brass buttons, as well as the buttons themselves. It was on the order of coin or stamp collecting. No rational explanation could ever be given. And high prices were being paid by wealthy collectors. "I will give you an example," the Major had said. "Do you know what is meant by horrors of war cards?" He had eyed Childan with avidity. Searching his memory, Childan had at last recalled. The cards had been dispensed during his childhood with bubblegum, a cent apiece. There had been a series of them, each card depicting a different horror. "A dear friend of mine," the Major had gone on, "collects horrors of war. He lacks but one now, the sinking of the Panay. He has offered a substantial sum of money for that particular card." "Flip cards," Childan had said suddenly. "Sir?" "We flipped them. There was a head and a tail side on each card." He had been about 8 years old. "Each of us had a pack of flip cards. We stood, two of us, facing each other. Each of us dropped a card so that it flipped in the air. The boy whose card landed with the head side up, the side with the picture, won both cards." How enjoyable to recall those good days, those early happy days of his childhood. Considering, Major Humo had said, "I have heard my friend discuss his horrors of war cards, and he has never mentioned this. It is my opinion that he does not know how these cards actually were put to use." Eventually, the Major's friend had shown up at the store to hear Childan's historically first-hand account. That man, also a retired officer of the Imperial Army, had been fascinated. "Bottle caps!" Childan had exclaimed without warning. The Japanese had blinked uncomprehendingly. "We used to collect the tops from milk bottles as kids. The round tops that gave the name of the dairy. There must have been thousands of dairies in the United States. Each one printed a special top." The officer's eyes had glinted with the instinct. "Do you possess any of your sometime collection, sir?" Naturally, Childan did not, but probably it was still possible to obtain the ancient, long-forgotten tops from the days before the war, when milk had come in glass bottles rather than throwaway pasteboard cartons. And so, by stages, he had gotten into the business. Others had opened similar places, taking advantage of the ever-growing Japanese craze for Americana. But Childan had always kept his edge. "Your fare," the Chink was saying, bringing him out of his meditation, "is a dollar, sir." He had unloaded the bags and was waiting. Absent-mindedly, Childan paid him. Yes, it was quite likely that the client of Mr. Tagomi resembled Major Humo. At least, Childan thought tartly, from my point of view. He had dealt with so many Japanese, but he still had difficulty telling them apart. There were the short, squat ones, built like wrestlers. Then the druggist-like ones. The tree-shrub-flower-gardener ones. He had his categories. And the young ones, who were to him not like Japanese at all. Mr. Tagomi's client would probably be portly, a businessman smoking a Philippine cigar. And then, standing before the Nippon Times building, with his bags on the sidewalk beside him, Childan suddenly thought with a chill, suppose his client isn't Japanese? Everything in the bags had been selected with them in mind, their tastes. But the man had to be Japanese. A Civil War recruiting poster had been Mr. Tagomi's original order. Surely only a Japanese would care about such debris. Typical of their mania for the trivial, their legalistic fascination with documents, proclamations, ads. He remembered one who had devoted his leisure time to collecting newspaper ads of American patent medicines of the 1900s. There were other problems to face. Immediate problems. Through the high doors of the Nippon Times building, men and women hurried, all of them well-dressed. Their voices reached Childan's ears, and he started into motion. A glance upward at the towering edifice, the highest building in San Francisco. Wall of offices, windows, the fabulous design of the Japanese architects, and the surrounding gardens of dwarf evergreens, rocks, the Karasansui landscape, sand imitating a dried-up stream winding past roots among simple, irregular flat stones. He saw a black who had carried baggage, now free. At once Childan called, "Porter!" The black trotted toward him, smiling. "To the 20th floor," Childan said in his harshest voice. "Sweet B, at once!" He indicated the bags and then strode on toward the doors of the building. Naturally, he did not look back. A moment later, he found himself being crowded into one of the express elevators, mostly Japanese around him, their clean faces shining slightly in the brilliant light of the elevator. Then, the nauseating upward thrust of the elevator, the rapid click of floors passing, he shut his eyes, planted his feet firmly, prayed for the flight to end. The black, of course, had taken the bags up on a service elevator. It would not have been within the realm of reason to permit him here. In fact, Childan opened his eyes and looked momentarily. He was one of the few whites in the elevator. When the elevator let him off on the 20th floor, Childan was already bowing mentally, preparing himself for the encounter in Mr. Tagomi's offices. Chapter 3. At sunset, glancing up, Juliana Frink saw the dot of light in the sky shoot in an arc, disappear to the west. "One of those Nazi rocket ships," she said to herself, "flying to the coast, full of big shots. And here I am down below." She waved, although the rocket ship, of course, had already gone. Shadows advancing from the Rockies. Blue peaks turning to night. A flock of slow birds, migratory, made their way parallel with the mountains. Here and there, a car turned its headlights on. She saw the twin dots along the highway. Lights, too, of a gas station. Houses. For months now, she had been living here in Cannon City, Colorado. She was a judo instructor. Her workday had ended, and she was preparing to take a shower. She felt tired. All the showers were in use by customers of Ray's gym, so she had been standing, waiting outdoors in the coolness, enjoying the smell of mountain air, the quiet. All she heard now was the faint murmur from the hamburger stand down the road by the highway's edge. Two huge diesel trucks had parked, and the drivers in the gloom could be seen moving about, putting on their leather jackets before entering the hamburger stand. She thought, didn't Diesel throw himself out the window of his stateroom? Commit suicide by drowning himself on an ocean voyage? Maybe I ought to do that. But here there was no ocean. But there is always a way, like in Shakespeare. A pin stuck through one's shirt front and goodbye, Frank. The girl who need not fear marauding homeless from the desert walks upright in consciousness of many pinched nerve possibilities in grizzled, salivating adversary. Death instead by, say, sniffing car exhaust in highway town, perhaps through long, hollow straw. Learned that, she thought, from Japanese. Imbibed placid attitude toward mortality, along with money-making judo. How to kill, how to die, yang and yin. But that's behind now. This is Protestant land. It was a good thing to see the Nazi rockets go by overhead and not stop, not take any interest of any sort in Cannon City, Colorado. Nor in Utah, or Wyoming, or the eastern part of Nevada, none of the open, empty desert states or pasture states. We have no value, she said to herself. We can live out our tiny lives, if we want to, if it matters to us. From one of the showers, the noise of a door unlocking. A shape, large Miss Davis, finished with her shower, dressed, purse under her arm. Oh, were you waiting, Mrs. Frink? I'm sorry. It's all right, Juliana said. You know, Mrs. Frink, I've gotten so much out of judo, even more than out of Zen. I wanted to tell you. Slim your hips the Zen way, Juliana said. Lose pounds through painless satori. I'm sorry, Miss Davis. I'm wool gathering. Miss Davis said, did they hurt you much? Who? The Japs, before you learned to defend yourself. It was dreadful, Juliana said. You've never been out there on the coast, where they are. I've never been outside of Colorado, Miss Davis said, her voice fluttering timidly. It could happen here, Juliana said. They might decide to occupy this region, too. Not this late. You never know what they're going to do, Juliana said. They hide their real thoughts. What did they make you do? Miss Davis, hugging her purse against her body with both arms, moved closer in the evening darkness to hear. Everything, Juliana said. Oh, God! I'd fight, Miss Davis said. Juliana excused herself and walked to the vacant shower. Someone else was approaching it with a towel over her arm. Later, she sat in a booth at Tasty Charlie's Broiled Hamburgers, listlessly reading the menu. The jukebox played some hillbilly tune, steel guitar and emotion-choked moaning. The air was heavy with grease smoke, and yet the place was warm and bright, and it cheered her. The presence of the truck drivers at the counter, the waitress, the big Irish fry cook in his white jacket at the register making change. Seeing her, Charlie approached to wait on her himself. Grinning, he drawled, Missy want tea now? Coffee, Juliana said, enduring the fry cook's relentless humor. Ah, so, Charlie said, nodding. And the hot steak sandwich with gravy. Not have bowl rat's nest soup? Or maybe goat brains fried in olive oil? A couple of the truck drivers, turning on their stools, grinned along with the gag, too. And in addition, they took pleasure in noticing how attractive she was. Even lacking the fry cook's kidding, she would have found the truck driver scrutinizing her. The months of active judo had given her unusual muscle tone. She knew how well she held herself, and what it did for her figure. It all has to do with the shoulder muscles, she thought as she met their gaze. Dancers do it, too. It has nothing to do with size. Send your wives around to the gym and we'll teach them. And you'll be so much more content in life.
Stay away from her, the fry cook warned the truck drivers with a wink. She'll throw you on your can.
She said to the younger of the truck drivers, Where are you in from?
Missouri, both men said.
Are you from the United States? She asked.
I am, the older man said. Philadelphia, got 3 kids there. The oldest is 11.
Listen, Juliana said, is it easy to get a good job back there?
The younger truck driver said, Sure, if you have the right color skin.
He himself had a dark, brooding face with curly black hair. His expression had become set and bitter.
He's a wop, the older man said.
Well, Juliana said, didn't Italy win the war? She smiled at the young truck driver, but he did not smile back. Instead, his somber eyes glowed even more intensely, and suddenly he turned away. I'm sorry, she thought, but she said nothing. I can't save you or anybody else from being dark. She thought of Frank. I wonder if he's dead yet. Said the wrong thing, spoke out of line. No, she thought, somehow he likes Japs. Maybe he identifies with them because they're ugly. She had always told Frank that he was ugly, large pores, big nose. Her own skin was finely knit, unusually so. Did he fall dead without me? A fink is a finch, a form of bird, and they say birds die. Are you going back on the road tonight? She asked the young Italian truck driver.
Tomorrow.
If you're not happy in the U.S., why don't you cross over permanently? She said. I've been living in the Rockies for a long time, and it isn't so bad. I lived on the coast in San Francisco. They have the skin thing there, too.
Glancing briefly at her as he sat hunched at the counter, the young Italian said,
Lady, it's bad enough to have to spend one day or one night in a town like this. Live here? Christ! If I could get any other kind of job and not have to be on the road eating my meals in places like this.
Noticing that the fry cook was red, he ceased speaking and began to drink his coffee. The older truck driver said to him,
Joe, you're a snob.
You could live in Denver, Juliana said. It's nicer up there. I know you East Americans, she thought. You like the big time, dreaming your big schemes. This is just the sticks to you, the Rockies. Nothing has happened here since before the war. Retired old people, farmers, the stupid, slow, poor, and all the smart boys have flocked east to New York, crossed the border legally or illegally. Because, she thought, that's where the money is, the big industrial money, the expansion. German investment has done a lot. It didn't take long for them to build the U.S. back up. The fry cook said in a hoarse, angry voice,
Buddy, I'm not a Jew lover, but I seen some of those Jew refugees fleeing your U.S. in 49, and you can have your U.S. If there's a lot of building back there and a lot of loose, easy money, it's because they stole it from those Jews when they kicked them out of New York. That goddamn Nazi Nuremberg law. I lived in Boston when I was a kid, and I got no special use for Jews, but I never thought I'd see that Nazi racial law get passed in the U.S. Even if we did lose the war, I'm surprised you aren't in the U.S. armed forces, getting ready to invade some little South American republic as a front for the Germans, so they can push the Japanese back a little more.
Both truck drivers were on their feet, their faces stark. The older man picked up a ketchup bottle from the counter and held it upright by the neck. The fry cook, without turning his back to the two men, reached behind him until his fingers touched one of his meat forks. He brought the fork out and held it. Juliana said,
Denver is getting one of those heat-resistant runways so that Lufthansa rockets can land there.
None of the three men moved or spoke. The other customers sat silently. Finally, the fry cook said,
One flew over around sundown.
It wasn't going to Denver, Juliana said. It was going west, to the coast. By degrees, the two truck drivers reseated themselves.
The older man mumbled. I always forget. They're a little yellow out here. The fry cook said, No Japs killed Jews in the war or after. No Japs built ovens. Too bad they didn't, the older truck driver said. But picking up his coffee cup, he resumed eating. Yellow, Juliana thought. Yes, I suppose it's true. We love the Japs out here. Where are you staying? She asked, speaking to the young truck driver, Joe. Overnight.
I don't know, he answered. I just got out of the truck to come in here. I don't like this whole state. Maybe I'll sleep in a truck.
The Honeybee Motel isn't too bad, the fry cook said.
Okay, the young truck driver said. Maybe I'll stay there, if they don't mind me being Italian.
He had a definite accent, although he tried to hide it. Watching him, Juliana thought, it's idealism that makes him that bitter. Asking too much out of life. Always moving on, restless and griped. I'm the same way. I couldn't stay on the West Coast, and eventually I won't be able to stand it here. Weren't the old-timers like that? But, she thought, now the frontier isn't here. It's the other planets.
She thought, he and I could sign up for one of those colonizing rocket ships. But the Germans would disbar him because of his skin, and me because of my dark hair. Those pale, skinny Nordic SS fairies in those training castles in Bavaria. This guy, Joe whatever, hasn't even got the right expression on his face. He should have that cold, but somehow enthusiastic look, as if he believed in nothing and yet somehow had absolute faith.
Yes, that's how they are. They're not idealists like Joe and me. They're cynics with utter faith. It's a sort of brain defect, like a lobotomy. That maiming those German psychiatrists do as a poor substitute for psychotherapy. Their trouble, she decided, is with sex. They did something foul with it back in the 30s, and it has gotten worse. Hitler started it with his, what was she, his sister? Aunt? Niece? And his family was inbred already. His mother and father were cousins. They're all committing incest, going back to the original sin of lusting for their own mothers. That's why they, those elite SS fairies, have that angelic simper, that blonde baby-like innocence. They're saving themselves for Mama. Or for each other. And who is Mama for them, she wondered. The leader? Herr Bormann, who is supposed to be dying, or the sick one? Old Adolf, supposed to be in a sanitarium somewhere, living out his life of senile paresis. Syphilis of the brain, dating back to his poor days as a bum in Vienna. Long black coat, dirty underwear, flop houses. Obviously it was God's sardonic vengeance, right out of some silent movie. That awful man struck down by an internal filth. The historic plague for man's wickedness. And the horrible part was that the present-day German Empire was a product of that brain. First a political party, then a nation, then half the world. And the Nazis themselves had diagnosed it, identified it, that quack herbal medicine man who had treated Hitler, that Dr. Morell who had dosed Hitler with a patent medicine called Dr. Koester's anti-gas pills. He had originally been a specialist in venereal disease. The entire world knew it. And yet the leader's gabble was still sacred, still holy writ. The views had infected a civilization by now, and like evil spores, the blind, blonde Nazi queens were swishing out from Earth to the other planets, spreading the contamination. What you get for incest? Madness, blindness, death. Brr. She shook herself. Charlie, she called to the fry cook, you about ready with my order? She felt absolutely alone.
Getting to her feet, she walked to the counter and seated herself by the register. No one noticed her, except the young Italian truck driver. His dark eyes were fixed on her. Joe, his name was. Joe what? She wondered. Closer to him now, she saw that he was not as young as she had thought. Hard to tell, the intensity all around him disturbed her judgment. Continually, he drew his hand through his hair, combing it back with crooked, rigid fingers. There's something special about this man, she thought. He breathes death. It upset her and yet attracted her. Now the older truck driver inclined his head and whispered to him. Then they both scrutinized her, this time with a look that was not the ordinary male interest.
Miss, the older one said. Both men were quite tense now. Do you know what this is?
He held up a flat, white box, not too large. Yes, Juliana said. Nylon stockings. Synthetic fiber made only by the great cartel in New York, I.G. Farben. Very rare and expensive.
You gotta hand it to the Germans. Monopoly's not a bad idea.
The older truck driver passed the box to his companion, who pushed it with his elbow along the counter toward her. You have a car? The young Italian asked her, sipping his coffee. From the kitchen, Charlie appeared. He had her plate.
You could drive me to this place.
The wild, strong eyes still studied her, and she became increasingly nervous, and yet increasingly transfixed.
This motel, or wherever I'm supposed to stay tonight. Isn't that so?
Yes, she said. I have a car. An old Studebaker. The fry cook glanced from her to the young truck driver, and then set her plate before her at the counter.
This ends side two of cassette one of The Man in the High Castle. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette two.